Heather?
And I'll open a public hearing. Now, before I do that, I'm gonna close a public hearing that I banged on. We have our missing member with us today. And we're very glad to welcome Senator Carter to our midst. And, Senator, would you mind just for the record, giving a little of your history and where you're from and so forth for the benefit of the committee? We all did that the other day. I held it off one time. Didn't have but half my committee here, and so we went ahead and the rest of us did that on Wednesday.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and,
Microphone is yours.
Thank you. Well, it's nice to be on your committee, and I appreciate that a lot. I served, as you know, 14, as you may or may not know, 14 years in the House, and the first, 6 of those years was on Human Resources Committee, and then served the next 10 years, Human Resources Ways and Means Committee, and 3 emergency boards in that period of time as well. I come from the northernmost Senate district in the state, and have just been engaged in human services issues as a result of the new job that I have as president of the Urban League of Portland, where we deal with issues for those people who tend to be voiceless in our society, whether they're the elderly or our children. So I work on both ends of that spectrum, and have found a great joy and excitement in being able to serve that level of constituency. Look forward to working on this committee, because I think everybody who has ever been in the legislature should have the opportunity to serve on human resources, because it gives you a way of looking at the needs of the real people. And so I call them the real people because human resources was designed to do that and for us to be able to work with those people who tend to be voiceless in our society. So that's what I enjoy about this work, and I look forward to that. I'm a mother of 9 grown children and 25 grandkids and 2 great-grandkids. So my life.
You're going to shove us out of the rural area.
Shove you out. That's right. That's right. So big family.
Well, we're very glad to have you in the Senate and have you on this committee, and we'll be leaning on your expertise, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Because you predate and have had many more years of experience than the rest of us here on the committee, and we're glad you're back. And sad that you were gone for some of the reasons that you were.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll look forward to, a fairly interesting session.
Well, I look forward to an interesting session, Mr. Chairman, and I hope that as we serve on this committee together, that when our views clash, it does not mean that as human beings we don't, that we just separate ourselves from each other, but that we can respect each other's beliefs and philosophies in terms of our differences, because I think at the core of all of us who come to this place called the Oregon Legislature is the means of goodwill for helping the people of Oregon.
I kind of smiled when you said everybody should have the experience of working on a committee like this and dealing with the folks that we deal with,
right,
problems that we deal with. The former legislator, Andy Anderson.
Yes.
I ran against him in the primary in his first session. It was my first in his first political race, and he won and then was elected. And I'm sure you served with
I did
years.
Serve with Andy, uh-huh.
And when I was elected to the Senate and went from the House to the Senate, he got a little bit in his cups one night at a Christmas party, and he collared and buttonholed me in the living room with this friend of ours, and said, Bill, he said, whatever you do, don't let them put you on the Health and Human Services Committee, much less be the chair of the Health and Human Services Committee. So I ignored his good advice. And but it has been an experience that I consider, like you do, that it's a rewarding experience. It's a tough situation to deal with, and everybody's problem in a Health and Human Services issue is a potential tragic situation, and not to be dealt with lightly or frivolously. I think we do have a large responsibility, and I'm happy to have the rest of the committee members that I do here, too, because I think we've got an excellent committee. Well, I'll go ahead then and thank you, Vice Chair Senator Carter.
Thank you.
In the public hearing on Senate Bill 42, and we got the list of those that have wished to speak. If Andrew will get that, I'll let you go ahead and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Senate Bill 42 requires the Senior Disabled Service Division to set performance standards for programs, basically Area Agency on Aging, to regularly review compliance with those standards. Requires the division to conduct annual financial audits of these agencies and do periodic reviews of these agencies regarding staff-client ratio, staff-management ratios, and the amount of money they get from outside contributions. In a little background, the division, Senior Disabled Services Division, is a state agency responsible for a number of programs for people who are elderly and seniors, including long-term care, case management, Oregon Project Independence, general assistance, licensing long-term care facilities, and other programs. They have, their last biennial budget was $1.2 billion. Many of their services are carried out through their 18 Area Agency on Aging entities throughout the state. AAAs, as they're known, carry out some of the services. SDSD has field offices that carry out other and similar services. AAAs are differentiated between Type A and Type B types of programs, depending on the services they provide. And then the Type B facilities also contract where they have AAA managerial overseeing state employees. Others transfer all services from the state to the local entity, the AAA, so all the people are actually working for the local entity versus the state. In a 2000 audit, from the Legislative Audit Committee, it found that the division does not require a clear measure of performance measures and outcomes or cost effectiveness of services. Therefore, they find it was difficult for them to assess the effectiveness of the services they provide if they're being done in a cost-effective manner, in terms of reimbursing and contractual arrangements with AAAs. They recommended that this lack of good cost performance information really kind of prevents them from doing a good assessment of future services and current services.
Thank you. We have a real negative approach to this. Don't find anybody that's willing to come and sing its praises here today. So I guess we'll just launch into and find out all the negative things about this bill. And don't smile. I guess probably, and I would say that in before we have anyone up to, or perhaps I'll ask Dan Kaplan to come up and on his way up, just mention that it bothers me when there's apparent some evidence of inequitable funding between some of the same needs between the different AAAs, just depending upon how they're set up. So that does concern me, maybe as much as this whole lack of oversight or something, but we'll soon hear some interesting words, I guess, from the other side, as we've heard some of the problems through the audit committee, and recognize that this wasn't a bill that I necessarily dreamed up. This is one that was handed to us from the audit committee. So go ahead, Mr. Kaplan.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Dan Kaplan, and I am the Deputy Administrator for Senior and Disabled Services Programs at the Department of Human Services. Committee staff is did a very good job recounting where the bill comes from in a brief sort of way. And we are, as Senator Fisher noted, opposing the bill. We are not opposing the bill because we disagree necessarily with the principles on which the bill is based, but we are opposing it because of the fiscal impact of the bill. In the Joint Legislative Audit Committee process, it was pointed out that the Senior and Disabled Services Division did not have a standard set of measures for gauging AAA performance. At the time that finding was made, or even before it was made, we began the process of developing a standard set of measures and a standard set of information to allow reporting on the performance of AAAs and senior and disabled services field units, because as the committee administrator pointed out, in many parts of the state, they do similar things. In some parts of the state, a function is handled by an area agency on aging. In other parts of the state, that same function is handled by a senior and disabled services division office. So we have developed a set of indicators or measures of performance, which are helpful in gauging the way the work is done in different parts of the state. We have also developed a field review process that that causes staff from both our central office and from field units to visit other field units and to conduct a review and to present findings. And those findings are designed to help improve quality of services. The opposition to the bill, as I said before, comes not because we disagree that more work could be done at evaluating performance, but that the costs of the bill as written are high and outside the governor's budget. In order to do this, we would have to do a level of financial audit that we are not now equipped to do. We would have to do what in essence is analyses of individual transactions or samples of individual transactions, as opposed to relying on the kind of aggregated cost information that we currently get both from our own computer systems and from fiscal reports submitted to us by the AAAs. And that higher level of financial audit adds costs to the process of gauging performance. In addition, the bill institutionalizes what we have done this biennium as a pilot project, requiring us to do regular field reviews of AAA performance. And the difficulty that we have there really comes from the way we've been funding our pilot. We've been funding it by bringing staff in on job rotations, and we've been paying for them by means of leaving other positions unfilled. In our proposed budget for 2001-03, the unfilled positions have been eliminated, so we no longer have that revenue source. So the cost of providing workers to do the field audits would be over and above what's in the governor's budget. That really does explain our opposition to the bill. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Shields.
Dan, it seems to me that the idea of the bill revolves around the fact that you want to know more about what the AAAs are doing and so on and so forth. But when you say the word auditing, since there's federal money, don't they already have federal auditing going on?
AAAs are required to have an annual audit by an external auditor. And those audits are submitted to our agency once a year. And those audits look at AAA financial practices at a very high level, and at that level they are very good. They are used to establish fiscal integrity at that high level. As we read this bill, it in fact would require much more of a detailed transaction-based analysis, and that's much more costly and much more labor-intensive than what's done currently.
Follow-up question. In the backgrounder that we got on this, there was a sentence that says that SDSD does not require clear measures of performance outcomes, cost effectiveness of services provided by AAAs. I say this for the committee, and it is in the form of a question. It'll take me a second to get there. But last year I was asked by Jim McConnell in Multnomah County to join a long-range planning group with their aging and disability services, which is their AAA, I guess. And I was amazed. I mean, we were there all day one day, and then we came back for a half a day every day for months. I mean, like once every 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And it was a real comprehensive kind of planning process in which I'm pretty sure that they looked at every aspect of quote-unquote performance outcomes, cost-effectiveness of services. My question then is, if that's happening in Multnomah County, is it not probably happening in other counties? In other words, even though SDSD doesn't have maybe the staff to do all of that stuff, it's being done at the county level in most cases. Is that not true?
Senator Fisher, Senator Shields, I think that is true. AAAs are organizations that do an extensive planning process, and as part of that, they do a self-evaluation on a regular basis. They do collect their own information, and they do evaluate their own information, and they have local boards to which they are accountable, and those local boards are certainly interested in the quality of their service. That's separate and apart from our oversight of their operations. I think that the finding of the JLAC staff that there was not a comprehensive review needs to be put in context. The finding was that there was not a comprehensive review and not a set of specific indicators that said, yes, you, Multnomah County AAA, are doing well on this one. You, Clackamas AAA, are doing less well on this one. You, Washington County AAA, are doing so-so on this one. We don't have that, but we do have a great deal of information about AAA performance, and we do use that information to understand what's happening with our program. We also use that information to communicate with the AAAs about issues in the system and potential problems in the system, and to work together to develop plans to deal with problems in the system. So, I think it is, I don't dispute the central finding that there's not a central report, but I would say that I'm not entirely in agreement in what that finding connotes, which is that in some way this is a system that's not accountable, because I do believe it is an accountable system.
Question?
Yes.
Are you good? Dan, I started to ask the real Dan to stand up because I haven't seen you with a beard on. Anyway, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I just want to tell you up front, I got to ask some questions, but I think this bill is unnecessary. And so just in case they haven't said that, I think it's personally unnecessary.
Senator Cargill, I'll let you take that up with Senator Duncan, who was the chair of the committee.
Oh, right. But I must say, I have to ask some questions in terms of, if you look at the AAAs, and you look at what you guys call the transfer AAAs versus, what was the other kind?
Senator Carter, the contract AAA.
Yeah, contract AAA. Then how do we know there is equity in terms of the delivery of services? How do we know there is equity in terms of the numbers of dollars that are being given? How do we know that our poor, voiceless seniors who don't have the money are getting the same level of treatment, if you will, in terms of staff and all this kind of stuff that they're supposed to be getting, if there is not some continuity in terms of the information that is being gathered?
Well, there is a great deal of information that's gathered and that is reported.
Right.
Let me try and...
Keyword continuity. That's the piece I'm looking for. Because I've heard and believe that you guys do get a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And I know you're pretty tough. I like that. So I already know that. This is not questioning that. Where is the continuity in terms of all the information that you do get, and how can you be on top of the kind of assessments in terms of equity in the system?
Right. And I think the answer to that in terms of data is that it's possible to put out reports, and our staff are now codifying a lot of information and pulling them together in reports in ways that look at, what level of, what number of folks are served at a percentage of population, that looks at what the community resources in terms of care are, that looks at whether local offices or AAAs are successful in placing people in community-based care, and even more than that, placing them in their own homes, keeping them in their own homes. There are also cost measures, unit cost measures, that allow for comparison. So these are all the kinds of things that we can bring to bear to show consistency of service or its lack.
Dan, I just want you to put that on record because I know you're doing that. I looked at your budget every year since that one term I was out of the legislature, but you need to put that on record. And I think that is worthy of being noted, mm-hmm. that the department itself, Mr. Chairman, and I know where you're on this bill, sir, in terms of it's not being a committee bill from us, that they do have codified information from all of these people they can look at because of the unit of service and because of the measurement of us, the measures that are put into place. Is we operate a senior services center. I know all of that is required of us, so I know that, but I think it just needs to be put on record so that it shows that the department does have the information. Information is codified, and they can make some distinctions. Now, the next piece would be something that somebody else might be interested in, is do they make the thing, but that is not the subject of this bill today. Thank you.
I guess, Dan, the thing that that I think needs to be addressed, at least the thing that probably bothers me the most, is if there truly is an inequity in the funding of a particular service, it shouldn't cost a whole lot more to get it delivered in an urban area than it does to deliver it in a rural area, with the exception that a rural area might have more travel involved or something like that. But if there isn't any accounting as to the staff ratios and things like that that are maintained, and somebody is paid for running a lean operation less than somebody is paid for running a media operation, so to speak, that bothers me. And you know that I've had long experience in working with SDSD in the range of long-term care financing, and know that you would not allow, for instance, a nonprofit to be paid more for the same service in long-term care than you would allow for someone else, unless they can very carefully justify any type of deviation from a basic amount. You do allow for certain discrepancies and
well, that's based on client needs.
Yes, right. But what I'm saying is there is a little, very fine margin for a difference in food costs per day, for instance, between nursing homes, whether they're nonprofit or private. But you wouldn't say automatically, basically, that we'll allow all the nonprofits to have 20% more in their food service budget than you would allow a private nursing home to do the same thing. And that is what I guess I'm trying to get at, is the fairness here. And how do we do it without maybe doing some type of monitoring or maybe just a little better checking to ensure that that isn't being done?
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, the equity issue to which you speak is a complicated issue and one that's been discussed by the Legislative Assembly on a number of occasions over the years. And there is a difference in the reimbursement. It's not a difference. The transfer AAAs, the AAAs from the large western counties are, in fact, reimbursed at a lower rate per client than the state-operated offices. And that is something that's been substantiated. It's on the order of a 10% difference. And this is an issue, obviously a budgetary issue, that that was discussed last session, and the legislature determined last session to identify about $2 million of general funds to redress some but not all of the equity gap. and that was the action as of last session.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If Dan, how much you think it would cost if we were to institutionalize this bill? How much you think it would cost if we were to institutionalize this bill?
Well, my staff thinks that it would cost about $345,000 of general funds in the upcoming biennium, and then a little bit more subsequent. And the reason for the difference is phase-in.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
When you look at that $345,000 cost, if the money is not given them out of general fund dollars, that means you have to take it out of the funds they presently have, and that means that every little nonprofit organization across the state would be dinged for less dollars because they got to find the money somewhere. Now, when you think in terms of single services across the state, and especially in the Portland area, and you look at the unit costs that most nonprofits are getting, they can't afford any loss. We had to take a loss anyway. But when you look at having to put something like this into place, it's going to hit in the programmatic area of being able to do business on behalf of the people which the dollars are designed to serve the most. And unless the legislature can come up with the dollars by which they're asking these folk to do the bidding for this bill, I just think that it creates the kind of hardship at the community-based level that none of us would like to see have happen.
I guess I would answer that by saying I agree in principle. However, if in the process of operating these things, $345,000 is taken out and misspent in this process, the same thing arrives at the doorstep of the people that need the help. And those are some of the things that we have a hard time knowing, because without some of these things in process, it is very difficult to ascertain whether that's the case or whether it isn't. So it's kind of a catch-22.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I respectfully disagree in the sense that what we want to do is to get data that supports or rejects the notion that the state is being on top of the kinds of services that are being delivered to community-based organizations, and that there is equity in the system, then this committee could ask for that kind of reporting because they already have the data. If they were not gathering the data, Mr. Chairman, I can understand that, but they are gathering the data, so it appeared to me that we want to ask them for this data within a given period of time. And if we find out they don't have the data, then this bill makes sense.
Well, Senator Carter, that's exactly the problem, because it states right here plainly, and that's what came up in the audit committee, because I sat on the audit committee.
Uh-huh.
The audit report noted that the lack of good cost and performance information prevents SDSD from acting. So we don't have that information. We don't have it available to us to make that accurate assessment. At least that is the opinion of the group from the Secretary of State's office that did the work on that.
Can I ask a little question?
Yes, certainly.
Dan, can you tell me, is this data that the JLSAC is saying that you guys did not have was asked of you by them before the final report?
The staff of the JLAC, I think, looked at a lot of data, and what they objected to, as I understand it, it was not that data weren't available, but that data weren't pulled together in a way that was definitive and in one place, and allowed us to say, yes, this is a AAA that's not doing well. These are all doing well.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can you, at this given moment, give that data to JLAC if they were to ask you for that data set?
Yes. I think we probably could have at the time as well.
You could have at the time as well.
There is a difference, and I appreciate the point that they were making. There's a difference between having data and having a performance standard that says if you are below line X, then you're not doing well enough. And that's true. That's what we don't have.
Another question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So then at the time, were you given a set of questions to prepare yourself for the performance objectives that JLAC wants to see in place?
We discussed, certainly with committee staff, a great deal what performance objectives were and why in our belief there was accountability within the system. And you know, they differed with us. But we certainly discussed those things at the time.
Mr. Chairman, just a statement. I know, you know, everybody in the world knows that data is designed to do what you want it to do, to either prove your point or to disprove the other person's point. It would appear to me that if an audit committee or the agency that does the auditing wanted particular standards in place by which they would measure any of our agencies, then those people would be notified in terms of what they would be looking for in terms of the audits. And it appears to me that this agency and other agencies alike were not given information in terms of what they were going to be measured upon. So if you're going to have performance objectives, if you're going to have expectations based upon performance objectives, then certainly the people that you're going to be measuring should be apprised of what you're going to be measuring them up on. It doesn't sound like they were measured based upon the likes or the information for which the auditing committee was going to audit them on.
Well, I guess, again, in answer to that, that's exactly what we're trying to arrive at here, I believe, because that's in the opening statement there that says the 2000 Joint Legislative Audit Committee report of SDSD notes that the division does not require clear measures of the performance outcomes and cost effectiveness of service provided by the AAA through its field offices, and therefore, how do we arrive to this? I guess is trying to, as I read it, is trying to arrive at a method of establishing that and putting that into practice. And it may boil down to the fact that something like this goes to Ways and Means and languishes there to the end of the session and drops off the end of the world. I don't know. Or we may decide not to do anything with it here. That's I have one vote, you have one vote.
That's right.
But anyway, I think...
No, Mr. Chairman, you have three. Let's be clear, Mr. Chairman.
Well...
I have one, you have three.
Senator.
Yeah, I don't operate in the right manner.
Senator Fisher, members.
I really pull a coattail to my colleagues.
Members of the committee, I would suggest that it is in fact possible, and that we have been moving in the direction of putting together a great deal of data, pulling it together in one place, which allows us to create the sort of performance measures that the JLAC was talking about, and allows us to do it without the extra expense associated with the bill as written. And the reason I believe that's true is that there is a great deal of computer-generated information about numbers of folks served, about resources in the community, about error rates for determining eligibility for food stamps, about timeliness with providing services, and about a host of other issues that are very important in operations. Those data are available now, and those data can be pulled into a unified performance report, and we are, in fact, moving in the direction of doing that. What we don't have the financial or the personnel resources to do is the sort of stuff that this bill is asking us to do in terms of instituted field reviews and instituted financial audits. And, you know, the whole question of accountability is one where, as you point out, Senator Fisher, there are always risks. And I believe that one needs to make a judgment about how much information one can get cheaply and how much risk is out there, and whether an organization, or in this case the legislature, wants to make a judgment that it will spend additional money to get slightly more information. You know, this bill would call on us to provide that information, and all I'm saying is that that has a cost. We can provide a great deal of information about AAA and SDSD field performance without doing this.
Glenn, let's approach this in a different way. You've admitted that there's a 10% difference in the funding of certain things due to if you're transfer or contract.
Right.
All right. Now, what on what basis was that decision made?
I wish, Senator Fisher, that I...
It's strictly a state-county situation, and you're the state, so you're going to pay the state more than you're going to pay the county?
Well, I wish I could say that there was an explicit decision made at some point in time that that was a thing that made sense to do. And I think that this is one of those situations that grew up over time and was not rectified over time. And as a result, we are in a situation now where fixing it is expensive.
All right, would you say this then? If the contracts only need 10% less, why don't you just take 10% away from the others, be done with it, have it accurate and even, and then you got more money to spend in something else or to increase a little bit to each one?
Well, the reason we're in the equity situation really has to do with the way budgeting is done. And without making this into a hearing on a whole other topic, the equity problem has occurred because with the transfer AAAs, the local government-based AAAs, there is a base budget, and every biennium that base budget is simply inflated by whatever the allowable inflation amounts are. For the contract AAAs and the SDSD field units, we are part of a state personnel system, which both gives negotiated COLAs and takes account of the fact that an aging workforce and a workforce that is becoming more senior in rank is paid more every year because we have a seven-tier step system for personnel. So if you looked at a given position, say a given case manager position, in the SDSD system and the contract AAA system, the cost of that position would be increased by the COLA, and if the same worker is in the position, 2 years later, she would have gotten two step increases. In the transfer AAA system, what happens is we, at the time an agency becomes transfer AAA, we turn over to them all of the money that's being paid to workers and all of the other personnel expenses and all of the supply and services expenses. But each biennium, we don't update that amount to take account that their workers are becoming more senior. We simply give them inflation on the base amount that they've got. And the result over time is that the aggregate reimbursement to transfer AAAs has slipped behind the aggregate reimbursement to SDSD and contract AAA units. And that's a situation that the legislature understood last session, and that's why they moved to redress at least some of the gap.
Is there a possibility that transfer agencies can get back on a contract basis?
That's a possibility, certainly.
They're not prohibited from that one.
They are not prohibited from doing that.
I was not on that particular discussion, so I'm asking questions probably that you've answered 50 times, and I apologize for that. But
I don't mind answering them 51.
Yeah, it's difficult to always know, and again, you see the logical thing that comes to my mind is if you've got two children out there and you're treating one different than the other one, that it would seem fairly easy to rectify that and straighten it up. And so as your explanation, I can understand where you are a bit caught between a rock and a hard place on that also. And even if they did come back in as a contract instead of a transfer, they would have to come in back from where the points that they're at now, which would never catch them up to where the others were. So in some ways, it's probably a good system from the monitoring basis of having maybe more local control and more local ability to deal with the situations as they see it without having to go back to the state, but also then having a bit trimmed their opportunities financially in the process.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Messer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm brand new to this game in human services, human resources, so this is a tremendous learning experience for me, but I have served for several years on two different bank boards. One is a holding company and the other is an affiliate company, and I chair the audit committee of the holding company. And it's been my experience that and as you well know, the banking industry gets audited from every direction. And that oftentimes you can just bury yourself and your employees in workload and cost and audits. And really what needs to be done, in my opinion, is to refine the questions you ask and how you ask those questions and how you report those questions. And we're seeing, at least in the banking industry, where we're combining the federal audits with the state audits and doing them at the same time, just to save a tremendous amount of time and expense. And I guess what I think I'm picking up from this is that rather than maybe add more audits to the process, that we have an opportunity here to take a hard look at how do we combine these audits and maybe ask better questions and that we can document better. I guess I'd like your response if I'm totally off base. I fully admit that I'm a freshman at this process and learning, but is this kind of what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, I don't think you're off base at all. I think that's exactly what we propose to do in lieu of what's in Senate Bill 42. We propose to use the existing data sources, including audits that are currently required to be done of the AAAs, to pull together more information and to fashion a collection of information that allows people in an informed way to gauge performance, rather than requiring new sources of data which have expense associated with them.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
just a comment. If you were if I was sitting over there where Dan is right now, as one of your constituents, and you said to me, if you had a choice between being a contract agency versus a transfer agency, which would you choose? I would say transfer. Because as a nonprofit, for me to have to deal with the contracting piece means I'd have to bring in more staff, give less service. Even though I want our staff to have a decent salary, to have to pay at that scale would really cut back the opportunity for serving the numbers of people that we serve.
Maybe we ought to have a bill here to force everybody to be transferred. We're going to have to get along here a little bit, but I think that we've gotten some good information from you, Dan. I appreciate you being patient with us and letting us get some things off of our chest here, and also bringing us up to date on a little bit on the problems that you work with. It was a two-tier system here, so to speak, and I think it's helped, I know myself, to understand better why this would be, because it would have first blush look that the state was taking care of its own while it wasn't taking care of the county, when in reality circumstances might be pushing them into doing something that maybe they don't really wish to do, but it's just that they don't have any choice. So I appreciate that, and if there's no further questions, I'll ask Jacqueline Zimmer and Don Butch to come forward.
Yeah, sure.
You're both on the same side, so I don't think you'll get into a fight here on the witness stand.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of O4AD, the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And, right off the bat, I have to admit I'm in kind of a sticky spot. It's tough to appear before a committee and on a bill that pertains to accountability and say you're technically opposed to it. And
are you representing both transfer and contract agents?
Yes, I am.
Do you wish to put your conflict of interest statement here?
So noted. And it is actually, it is equity that got us to this in the first place. The fact that the state is not reimbursing our transfer agencies at the same rate that it reimburses itself, and the result of a longstanding problem with the Department of Administrative Services and that you touched on today, that's how we got to this bill today, because we made a case for the problems that we were having as a result of partnering with the state. And last session, we were about $8 million in the hole as a result of that partnership. And this session, it's closer to $10 million. And that money will grow and grow until we do fix that funding formula that caused the problem. So that aside, I just want to state that we're not opposed to accountability. We have an incredible amount of accountability and responsibility to the state and to our clients to run our area agencies on aging in a high performance manner and to respond to the needs of constituents using the money that's given to us. But as Dan has said before, there are audits being performed already, and if SDSD is underwhelmed or unimpressed with performance of a AAA, it can in fact come in and give us the boot and take it back over, and so they do monitor.
I don't believe the audit committee found that SDSD was dissatisfied.
No, but I'm saying
the audit committee itself were a bit frustrated in what they had to do with the information they had.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Well, but for us, we are aware that There's auditing going on constantly for us, and one thing that didn't come out in the JLAC report during the interim was any negligence on the part of the AAAs or any misspending of funds, or none of those things came forward. I think it's a very clean audit, I'm not sure exactly what we will change as a result of the field review that's been done on us, but you don't see anything in here that screams problem as far as the AAAs go. And another reason that this concerns us is that, as you know, the governor took a big bat to senior services in his recommended budget, and I'm not sure that we will ever fully recover from that. I know that people are working hard to restore the funding to those programs and to the seniors and persons with disabilities that are affected by the reductions. But I'm not sure we'll ever fully recover from that. And for us, a concern is, you can anticipate staffing reductions, and should we have our staff focusing on numbers, or can we continue to serve our clients at the staffing client ratio that we've already got right now? So it's just one thing for you to consider. And a number of our offices do have, as Dan alluded to, there are a number of numbers going on out there. There's monitoring going on in our offices, in a number of our offices as it is. And we ourselves see that there's a need for us to develop a standard within the state of monitoring, and we'll work towards that using, for example, the Multnomah County standard. So, we're on task. But we don't
use our rules.
Okay. Well, they have a very refined monitoring system, and others do as well. So, we think maybe there's a little bit of emphasis on the wrong syllable here. The problem is for us equity. We're not sure that the problem is monitoring, and I'm not sure that monitoring fixes the equity problem. So, I stand for any questions that you might have.
You make a hard case to argue against.
Thank you.
Don? Don, in the interest of time, can you, if you've got new things, can you present those and not go too much over what we've...
Yeah.
I'm going to take that liberty with you, because I know you'll get even with me at the governor's position if I take undue advantage of you here.
Well, our concern is just a little bit different, perhaps, than the others. We are facing the severe cuts of the governor's.
Would you introduce yourself? Excuse me for that.
I'm sorry. I'm John Butch. I'm a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I have a severe cold. You'd think a pharmacist even as old as I am would know what to do about it. We're concerned about the severe cuts that have occurred on the governor's recommended budget to both the OPI, the Oregon Project Independence, in the Medicaid long-term care sections that would affect about 7,500 frail people. it would also abolish some positions of case managers and caseworkers, eligibility workers. And in addition to that, the proposed budget requires SCSD to eliminate 34 positions. And we feel that along with these cuts, then, there's also the possibility that they would be required to fill 5 full-time professional positions in order to make the audit. And so we are concerned that these people will be, that there'll be a lot of frail people who will not be served, and that these are some of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens. So we're concerned possibly about the timing, that maybe the audit should be done next biennium or something.
I want to note for the record, when you mentioned you had a cold, that Jacqueline immediately moved about a foot.
I don't blame her.
Well, thank you for coming. I think I believe we've received a bit of education here that I know I didn't have, even after sitting on the audit committee. And again, I appreciate you taking the time to come. And I think that we need to do some talking over here of possibly going back to
leadership and finding out just which direction they wish to go, if they're not interested in fronting up the money to help us out in this process. So I appreciate everybody coming and testifying on it. And if no one else wishes to discuss it, I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on this bill and go on to another.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 42, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 157. I'll ask staff to introduce it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 157 allows a person who had a health screen test performed and the results released directly to that individual, but it does restrict test results that go to the individual to only contain clinical or lab findings and not a diagnosis. Currently, many clinical tests can only be ordered by a physician, dentist, or other person authorized by law, usually a medical type of person. Individuals aren't authorized by law to obtain many laboratory tests. The health department reports there are approximately 25,000 different types of lab tests. And in 1989, a health department task force developed a short list of approximately 7 different tests that can be done without a doctor's orders. These are health screening tests that those people come across in malls and places. This thing is blood, hemoglobin, pregnancy tests, blood and feces, the cholesterol types of tests. And the health department reports there are approximately 100 sites throughout Oregon that currently allow this type of health screening test.
Okay, I'm going to change a little bit from our order here. I know Michael Skeels from the Oregon Health Division is asked to testify, and he's first on the list, but since one of my constituents, Jim Burke, has asked to have this legislation prepared, and he's here he lived down close to Medford, or in the southern part of my district, I know. So you've come quite a little ways up here to give your input, and I have been made aware in the last couple of days that I think this bill is viewed as changing a lot of things that I don't believe it was Jim's idea to change. And so I'm going to let him go ahead and testify first here, and perhaps he can clarify a little few things. I can say outright right now, we will not be going into a work session on this bill today. It's obvious that we do have some amendments and things that we need to get and consider before we go into a work session. So this will just be a public hearing for testimony purposes today. Go ahead, Jim, and introduce yourself for the record and relax and
tell us about your need.
Chair, Senator Fisher and committee, my name is Jim Burke. I'm from Rogue River, Oregon, which is between Grants Pass and Medford. And I'm representing myself. I ran into this problem when I'm from Alaska. When I went to Grants Pass and saw a doctor and had a blood test, and anyhow, it turned out that I just wanted to go ahead and get a blood test, and they said, you can't. And actually, I've talked to Susan Morgan, Representative Sue Morgan a number of times, and we've exchanged a lot of email. She sent me a long list of people that would do, that she said would do blood tests, and I called probably 40 different places. And if you call a hospital, they say they will not do any blood tests. Well, most of them say they won't do any, and a few will say they will do cholesterol and a few of the minor things without a doctor's orders or prescription or something. Most of the people on the list she sent me were Fred Myers, and Fred Myers is gearing up to do the minor tests, the cholesterol and whatever, I guess, but they're not a hospital or a laboratory.
I believe in talking with you also that either you or your wife, one or the other, had some medical background or health-related background experience.
No.
I maybe got you wrong.
No. We have a chiropractor who, it's listed on here, is like a personal friend, and he's done a lot of blood work and works in nutrition, and we would rather go through nutrition to cure something than a medical doctor, and he does a blood analysis to determine what's lacking in your body. So when I went to the doctor the first time, he ordered us a blood test, and I went back to him and got a copy of it, and I did a little arm twisting and sent that to my chiropractor, and my chiropractor sent back and he said, well, it's very limited, this test. Here's what I think. So I wanted to get a more extensive test with what he recommended, and there is just no way without a doctor's. And so I have to go to a doctor and convince him that this is what I need, that's a doctor's appointment, just to get a blood test. If I went down and got a blood test, I don't mean to take this blood test and then shove it on somebody. I just want it for me. Or in this case, I can get to this chiropractor who can tell me what this stuff means. And of course, then most of us know what some of the things are, the cholesterol, and or if you have a particular problem, a person can be aware of that and look at it.
And basically, as I understood, this was not something that the person paid for himself. It was not something that was charged to an insurance company or...
No.
That kind of thing, or to workers' comp.
No, this...
That it would be demanded that a doctor take that and look at it or use it after you had gotten it.
I'd never even thought of that when I give this to you. This was strictly a personal thing. I want to know what my blood is. Maybe I'm taking this because I think it's helping me, and I can look and see it in the blood test, And then if I go to a doctor and I say, doctor, look at this blood test, it says such and such, well, then it's up to the doctor to go with this test to have another one, or, I don't want it for ammunition for anyone else. I just want it for me. And I don't see why, if I pay for a blood test, even from a doctor, why they don't give it to me. It's like, you can't have it. It belongs to me, but it's, I pay for it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Mesler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've just heard the answer, but as I read this bill, I see no mention of the bill only speaks to the individual himself. It doesn't speak to juveniles who might have authority over, or elderly people who an individual might have authority over. And I can see from what you just said that in your case you're not interested in that, but I would wonder if that shouldn't be a part of a bill such as this if it goes forward.
Well, I guess what I've always tried to do, Jim has got a bill here that he wishes to do, and I would certainly consult him before we did so-called friendly amendments. And if he doesn't mind cluttering his bill up a bit or that kind of thing, in this particular instance, I think we have a bill that's quality, and it's going to take a major amending effort probably to get it straightened up because I don't believe it's been drafted in exactly the manner in which he and I understood it, and largely that is because, again, we are not professionals in the field and don't understand all the ramifications. And I know when it came out and it mentioned about health screen, I took a look at it and I thought, well, they must know what they're doing, because health screen had never entered our conversation. So, like I said, starting yesterday with the OMA and today with the health lab, and later on with another group that panicked, we're having all kinds of people here that seem that they're worried about it's going to change their whole way of life and their whole structure of state operations and all this kind of thing. That wasn't, as I understood, my intent, and I believe you stated it pretty fairly, what you and I had understood. And so I'm committed to continuing to work with the bill, but I'm going to listen to the testimony today and solicit some help. And even if we have to go and draft another bill and discard this one, if it doesn't do the job, that because you're going to notice here the relating clause is to health screen tests, and that's not really what we're after here. And so in their interest of not changing related clause in a particular bill or amending the relating clauses, I may very well have to have another bill drafted to answer what we're doing. So thank you, Jim, and if you want to remain here during the time, I don't know when you have to get back, but you're sure more than welcome to stay here and listen to the rest of the testimony and stick around and talk with those that have presented testimonies to work on trying to get this matter settled out here while we've got the resources right with us here today.
Thank you.
So thank you for testifying. Thank you for being willing to come all the way up here a couple hundred miles to help us out. We'll call Michael Skeels and the folks with him from the Oregon Health Division if you wish to bring others with you.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Mike Skeels. I'm the director of the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory, which is part of the Health Division in the Department of Human Services. I've provided you with some written testimony. I'll just try to hit some of the high points. What I've asked Chairman Fisher for permission to do is just give you some background information about how labs are regulated now and what we see as possible implications of this bill. Pardon me. What this bill would do, as we read it, is would allow anyone who is currently holding a valid federal lab license or laboratory testing certificate in the state of Oregon to be able to do lab tests at the request of an individual without a physician's or other clinician's order, and then to give the results of those tests directly back to the person. And just a little word of explanation is probably necessary about the way labs are regulated. There's a federal law called the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, or CLIA for short. And under CLIA, there are four levels of laboratories: high complexity, moderate complexity, something called waived, meaning that they just do simple basic tests. And most of the tests that we're talking about in this situation fall in that category. And there's another category where physicians are doing the tests themselves hands-on, and that's sort of irrelevant to this situation. But we've got about 2,000 labs in Oregon that have certificates under CLIA. And we, Rita Choi, the manager of the lab licensing program, and the rest of us administer this federal program here in Oregon. And we also have state licensure, but currently the state licensure of clinical laboratories pretty much just says if you have a federal license, then that's the equivalent. And so we do issue a state license, but I don't want to confuse the issue. It's really the CLIA certificate that allows labs to work in the state. And as the committee administrator said, in 1989, there was a growing interest in what we call mall testing at the time. People wanted to be able to get a cholesterol test or triglycerides or even a pregnancy test or something else in a non-medical setting. And so the legislature passed a law which created something called a health screen testing permit. And it said to the health division, we want you to put in place some regulations that have to do with personnel qualifications for doing these tests and quality control measures. And we want these entities to have a relationship, a referral relationship to a physician. So if you find somebody with a sky-high glucose level and they might have diabetes, that gets referred to a doctor. And we want you to make sure that if these are done outside of a medical context, that there is adequate oversight to make sure that the consumers of these tests are protected. And that bill, as I said, created the health screen testing program that we currently have. The law, as it's set up now, directs the Health Division to set those standards that I just mentioned for quality assurance and personnel and so forth, and to create a list of the tests which can be done by one of these testing laboratories without a doctor's order under the rubric of health screen testing. The statute defines what health screen testing means, and it says, okay, Health Division, using that statute, tell us which tests you think qualify. And so we have a list of 7 tests, as the committee administrator said. There are things like screening blood for anemia and cholesterol and glucose and pregnancy testing and some things like that. So that's sort of where we are now. We've got about 100 non-medical health screen testing sites, and these are pharmacies. I think every Fred Meyer has one. These are places where any of us can go without a doctor's order and get those 7 tests done on a screening basis. And we don't really have any concerns about Senate Bill 157 if the intent is simply to expand the health screen testing, in other words, that limited range of screening tests, to all the licensed clinical labs in the state. In other words, if you want to say, well, any licensed clinical lab can do this. But in fact, that would be unnecessary because they can right now. There are 50 or so licensed medical laboratories that are moderate or high complexity labs that already have health screen testing permits. So you can go into any one of those labs without a doctor's order now and get one of those 7 tests done, okay? But we do have some questions and concerns if the intent of the bill is to allow individuals to order any and all clinical laboratory tests without the involvement of a practitioner. We've got really 2 lines of concern there. One of those has to do with payment issues. For example, will insurance companies be expected to cover these tests, and does this have the potential of setting up a 2-tiered system where some people who have money have access to these and other people don't? The second line of concern we have is that there are, we believe, a number of conditions where test results are really useful only in conjunction with the interpretation of a qualified healthcare professional. We think there are some kinds of tests which really should only be done in a medical context. And we think that not having that kind of interaction could be detrimental to the medical interests and even the economic interests of individuals. So we do have some concerns about that. But even having said that, we believe in patient empowerment, and we're really willing to work with anybody, Chairman Fisher, to try to craft something that meets everybody's needs. And with that, I'll just offer to answer any questions you might have. With that, we think we need more discussion and modification of the bill before we can fully support it.
I would have one question, and again, I think you fairly stated our intent, at least mine was, and what I had gathered from speaking with the Burks on this, was that it just empowered the person to walk in off the street personally and access the laboratory system as it exists, not making any change in the laboratory system whatsoever, but allow them to physically, personally access those services without having to go and get a doctor's permission and bring it back and then have the information sent to that doctor and then have to go and try to get it from the doctor when they in turn want to use it. And I gave you, for instance, my office, and again, I don't mean to hark to myself all the time, but I'm now on a 6-month check for my PSA test, as I mentioned, in my office after prostate surgery. And let's say that I was a bit of a hypochondriac and I really didn't want to wait 6 months to get a checkup, and yet my doctor wasn't willing to do it every 3 months or every month or something, I could then go myself and have that done. And I know enough now, having gone through this process, that I know the numbers that I would be looking for. And it might give me a great assurance, but it wouldn't be something that I would be putting in for my insurance company, be it private insurance, automobile insurance, SAIF, or workers' comp, anything like that, period. Nor would it be anything that I would want to be able to take to a doctor and then require him getting it from me secondhand, not having any control over the situation, to have to perhaps stretch his credibility with a potential lawsuit and that kind of thing over maybe accepting something that I had put together and concocted off my computer or something like that, which was false. So it basically, I didn't want to interfere with anything for the protection of the system or the protection of the professionals involved in the system, but just merely allow people for their own satisfaction to go and receive that information, because it came to my mind that we do have many health professionals that retire and no longer maintain their licenses or this type of thing that could very likely have some desire to maintain things for their own particular knowledge and would not necessarily have that privilege under our particular laws. And it also was to my brought to my attention that apparently some of this ability is practiced by other states, and we wouldn't necessarily be carving a whole bunch of new ground. But I'll have to admit, I didn't tumble because I'm not deep enough into the professional applications of this. And when the health screen thing came out, I thought, well, that wasn't what the terms that we were using, but wasn't aware of all the things that went behind the scenes, and trusted in legislative counsel having gotten the right terminology when maybe we weren't using the right terminology. So I don't believe that myself or the Burks, either one, are at all adverse to working to guarantee that the system stays the same, that we don't proliferate a bunch of people getting into maybe doing some midnight lab work and lab setups and that kind of thing and preying upon people, but we would want them to have the very best expert test done that we feel we're getting right now in our system, and would want that to continue without causing you to have to relicense or license a whole bunch of people or change your screening processes or affect those things in any way. So I really appreciate you taking your time to come and educate us, and if you could hang around just a little bit longer and listen to the testimony from the OMA, I would appreciate it very much, and then perhaps I can take a few minutes after we're through, because this is our last item on the committee, and meet with all of you together, and we can discuss the practicality of where we go from here.
Question?
Yes. Senator Carter.
Doctor, from what I can understand, is the access question here. So in the event I go to my doctor, he orders a test on me, I ask the people to do the test on my blood, and at that point, I've already paid for it anyway. Are you saying that there is, I'm going to ask you two questions, that's fine. Are you saying that there is a chance for abuse along those lines, number one? Number two, if I, as a private citizen, walked off the street into a certified laboratory, asked for a blood test for the following whatever reasons, are you saying also that that has a chance for abuse?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, because of the way the federal regulations are written under CLIA, the labs that are doing moderate and high complexity testing, in other words, these are like large clinical practices and hospitals, you know, the bigger, more complex labs, those are the ones that your physician is most likely going to send your lab test to, your blood test to, or he or she may operate his own laboratory, but under direct medical supervision. I'm not concerned about that situation at all. It's a highly regulated industry at that level. However, for the so-called waived labs, the thousands of, well, there are thousands, let me try that again, there are several hundred laboratories in Oregon where they have a CLIA certificate to do waived testing, simple basic testing, outside of any medical context. The only requirement in those laboratories under the federal law is that they use an FDA-approved method and that they follow the procedure that the manufacturer of that method sets forward. So people can buy kits. There, no one ever looks to see whether qualified personnel are doing the test. No one ever sees whether they actually are following the manufacturer's instructions. Your blood test would go somewhere. You wouldn't know where it was. Or you might, excuse me, in your second example, you would go into one of these labs. They would draw your blood. You wouldn't have any way of knowing whether the testing was being done right. And what I'm telling you is that the CLIA waiver system does not protect you adequately as a consumer in non-medical situations, in my judgment.
Okay, and I hear that. But I think if I hear Mr. Burke, with his questions, I might be wrong, but for the sake of asking the question, Mr. Burke, let's go along with my question in the direction in which I'm trying to ask the question. If you're my doctor, you've ordered my test, everything is on the up and up with a certified laboratory. Once you give me my results, I'm saying, doctor, now may I have my blood. What is the problem?
Senator Carter, are you asking, can you get your blood sample back?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. I thought you meant the results from your test.
He's going to give me the results of my test.
The results of your test.
But
under Oregon law, as it's currently written, the report can only go back to a licensed practitioner that submits the sample.
Therein lies the problem. That's what I think I'm hearing, Mr. Burford, you say that. I want to be able to have my own blood and take it to whom I please to take it to, or I want to be able to go into a certified laboratory environment that has been certified by the state and ask them to take my blood because I'm concerned about being low-blooded or either I'm concerned about cholesterol problems, and will you take my blood? I'm trying to find out, doctor, where is the chance for abuse in a situation of that nature?
Chairman Fisher, Senator Carter, I guess what I'm saying is that if you are under the care of a physician,
mm-hmm.
and your physician makes an informed choice about which laboratory to submit your sample
right.
to, and it's a laboratory that's certified either as, well, under any of the levels of CLIA, under medical supervision, I don't see a problem with the quality of that laboratory work. And in my experience, virtually all physicians would share the results with you, but it would have to come back through them. I want to be clear about that.
Right.
However, I am concerned that in those settings where there's non-physician laboratory testing going on under just a federal CLIA certificate.
I would be too.
Yeah, and then I'm concerned about those settings.
Yeah, I don't think I hear them saying they want to be able to have any fly-by-night folk up. They just want access in the certified traditional systems that you have right now. Give me my blood. That's what I think I'm hearing.
Well, Senator Carter, I don't believe they want their blood back, the sample back. They want the results back.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be able to donate that blood to a lab without having to have doctor's permission to donate it and the doctor recommending which test they have.
I see. Okay. This is it. Okay.
And I would guess, for instance, that I would go to XYZ lab, and that's where my doctor sends me, and it's close to my home and everything. And so if I wanted to get something in between time, I would go back into their doors. I would be getting the same service that my doctor would be getting. They wouldn't send it to a different lab, would they?
Senator Fisher, I'm not sure. It would depend on their practice.
But there again, doctors send it to labs outside of the state and all over the place. I mean, there's not any assurance even that a person that was going to an Oregon doctor would necessarily have an Oregon-controlled lab report.
Chairman Fisher, may I just say one more thing in response to Senator Carter's question? I just want to be clear that when I express these concerns about non-physician waived testing, that we currently have a safety net for those seven tests called the Health Screen Testing Permit Program, and that's why it was put in place by the legislature in 1989, was they shared the concern that I expressed, and I think I heard Senator Carter express as well, that we don't want people preyed upon,
right.
and we want an extra layer of consumer protection there by the Health Screen Testing Permit Program. So I feel okay about it right now, but I'm concerned that if it goes away, then we will have a
problem. We had no, as I mentioned, we never even mentioned or even heard the word health screen until the bill came back. So our feeling was not in any way to change your specific goals of having controlled and proper sources for people to go to and to trust in. All we wanted to do was be able to access those without having to make two trips to the doctor's office. Okay, thank you very much. Scott Gallant. Scott is representing the OMA, I take it, today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I see that you have no position. You're ambivalent.
Oh, well, I...
We had a little different situation. Everybody was against this other bill. Now, one is for this, one is neutral, and you didn't put down anything.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's always good to have a balance. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant, and I am representing the Oregon Medical Association. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, I too met with you briefly the other day and raised some concerns about the bill and what its purpose was and what effect it might have. And as you've heard from the Health Division, we believe that this bill does need a considerable amount of work. From our perspective, it is exceedingly important that complex lab tests, in fact, go through certified facilities for the assurance of the patient, and it is exceedingly important that you have qualified laboratory experience and medical expertise, again, for the benefit of a patient in the process. And what I believe I've been hearing, Mr. Chairman, is that that is your desire as well. I mean, clearly there are facilities for a very simple blood tests or other tests currently available. And it's not really clear from the proponent's testimony exactly what kinds of tests you're really trying to access that you might not be able to access already.
Now, this brings up a question that I wanted to ask you specifically. Are there lab tests that are being done as more or less routine? And I guess there was, 25,000 roughly different types of lab tests.
They're a huge number.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, 25,000 is a pretty large number to me when you think of, I don't want somebody sticking my arm 25,000 times trying to find out what's wrong with me. I hope they could combine some of these things. But in any event, that's a whale of a lot of tests. And I'm guessing that some of them are pretty rare and very seldom done. And what I really want to know is, are there any tests, to your knowledge, that require a physician's, for instance, presence or very direct coordinating with the lab because of life-threatening situations in regard to those tests that might be accessed if we just threw the door open to somebody to pick
Dr. Skiles may be, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Skiles might be the better person to ask that question, but my... my supposition, I believe it would be correct, is that yes, there are tests where you would want physician involvement, particularly in the interpretation of the test results. I mean, you begin to get into the arena of genetic testing, for example, just as an example, a very, you know, it's a basically a new process that's going to become more common over time. But again, I'm not sure that you necessarily would want individuals to merely walk into a lab and say, well, you know, I feel like I'm in the mood for test 2,399 because I'm curious about it. I mean, it just seems a little peculiar. You know, you usually want some indication, on average, that there is a medical purpose for an exam to be done, other than just pure curiosity. I mean, it's just kind of unusual. Now, the other issue that was brought up earlier, Mr. Chairman, was that there was some suggestion that patients, you know, didn't have access to lab test results. Patients do have access to that, obviously, but a physician is obligated to keep the test itself, and physicians all the time do get tests from previous primary care physicians or other specialists, et cetera, and keep them in the record as people transfer through, you know, to different physicians. Usually you have a coordinating physician, in essence. I use cancer as an example. You know, usually the oncologist is the physician who works with the surgeon, who works with the radiation oncologist, if that's necessary, et cetera, and they are aware of the treatment tests and results that are going on among themselves, at least.
Yeah. Well, my guess is that this would be considerably limited in this lab testing because a good many of the lab tests come from biopsies, which would not be part of this. This would be basically only a blood drawn type of testing, as I gather was Mr. and Mrs. Burke's type of thing, and would not be something, oh, I got a brown mole on my arm here, I'll just cut a hunk off my arm and send it into the lab and have it checked out. I don't think that is a...
Right, Mr. Chairman, I'm...
And so I think that the 25,000 list would be severely cut down in number simply because an awful lot of the tests require biopsies. And I would give you, for instance, I had a son that had a rare form of melanoma, and the doctor didn't think it was anything at all when he took it off, but he sent it in to pathology. It came back from the local lab that it was a particular type of cancer. He sent it on to another lab that he felt was maybe a little more sophisticated than that, and it came back that it wasn't. He still wasn't satisfied, and so he sent it to a third lab somewhere back east, and indeed it was. And so it was something that particular doctor had never seen in his entire career. So I can understand what you're saying about patient protection. However, a blood test wouldn't have shown that under any circumstances. And in this particular instance, my family member had put off, he knew it was there, and he put off going and having it done, and fortunately it was excised, and he's been 4 years without further reoccurrence, and we've kind of got our fingers crossed. But there again, there's nothing that says that if somebody did get their blood test, even with a doctor, and the doctor recommends that you've got a problem, the person still doesn't have to go through with the treatment, nor would he have to. If he saw it and he didn't like what he saw, he wouldn't necessarily have to go to a doctor to have it verified or do anything about it either. I mean, we all make a lot of choices. And so my feeling was that I didn't want to set up a situation where somebody would have the availability of a test that might have to be done under a doctor's supervision, and a lab person called in and maybe be ready to, I don't know, do anything from...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you're...
applying oxygen to that kind of thing. So I was trying to find out if we were just open it wide open, if we're doing something that is life-threatening.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't think that you would want a wide open system necessarily. I'm presuming that you most certainly would like to make sure that you have qualified labs with qualified personnel. Which I think is kind of...
There was never any hint of anything in our conversations that indicated that this would go to anything that wasn't up to snuff and
right.
Properly licensed. And again, as I assured you in my office, my understanding, and again, I've talked with Mr. Burke about that at considerable length prior to the meeting here today, and he assured me that I was on the right track, that this was merely to allow the person to go and ask for the blood sample through proper channels and sources and have the results sent to him rather than to the physician.
And Mr. Chairman, I mean, it's a fact of life that there are false positives in lab tests. I mean, that's just the way it is. Using your example, you could do a biopsy that either was not done deep enough, or it was a potential tumor that was not the right one, that wasn't really visible at the time, and you still have cancer. So these can be very complicated things, even if you do it all correctly along the way. My final point, Mr. Chairman, is I will be happy to work with the Health Division to look at this, see if there's a way to clarify it and fix it, but along the way. But again, I get the impression you're talking about a very minor number of potential tests here. Anyway.
Yes, with drawn blood, basically a drawn blood sample, and not any other type of a surgical invasion of the body. In your opinion, you've been around this situation a long time and know some about the rules and regulations, but my understanding is that we're not allowed to amend a relating clause, and I would guess here almost that we'd be better off to go to LC and have them draft another bill with a different relating clause and get rid of this health screen process altogether, because that's not what we want to change.
You're trying my memory bank, Mr. Chairman, but actually I think the cleanest way to do it is to just draft a clean bill and go that direction, even though I think you've probably gotten and stuffed this with appropriate language if that's what you wanted. But I believe in the Senate you may, in fact, change relating clause under particular circumstances with a vote. But, you know, it's been a year and a half. I haven't looked at the rules recently.
Well, I don't wish to test the patience of my Senate president here with too much of that.
I don't, at this stage of the game, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you really need to go through that.
But would you be available to stick around a couple minutes here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, is anyone that needs to have further testimony? I did hear and have some contact with, and I'm going to put that on record, with insurance companies and talk with them. I assured them also that that was not our intent to have them involved in any way, shape, or form in the payment of these at any level or in any form of insurance, that it was strictly a private pay. So is there any other further comments or questions here by the committee?
Hearing none,
I'm going to adjourn.
I'm a little unfamiliar if I can go directly to adjournment or if I...
I
will open
the record.
Committee hearing to change into the record that we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157 and adjourn committee.
Yes, sir.
Bill